Welcome everyone to the APA Latinos and Planning Division Plan Dulce podcast. My name is Vidal Marquez. I am the chair of the division. I'm also a planner in the city of Orange here in Southern California. I'm joined by my co-host, Heidi.
Hi, how are you? My name's Heidi Rita Lopez. I'm a planner with the LA City Planning Department and happy to be here.
Today we're here joined by two planners from the city of Los Angeles. We're doing a new series focusing on planning in the Los Angeles community, hearing from planners from Los Angeles. And we're joined today by Jaime Espinosa and Ana Vidal. And we'll go over their bios in just a moment. And I just want to remind you, you can join our podcast on all platforms. You can also join the division at APA website, planning.org. And you can find all our information on our webpage. And we bring you this podcast to talk about planning in Latino communities, talking to Latino planners, and all the topics unfolding across the country. This subject today is planning journeys and language access, and we're happy to have our guests here talk about their experiences as planners and working in the city of Los Angeles. And we're joined by our first guest. Jaime is a city planner in the Office of Zoning Administration for the City of Los Angeles. In his capacity, he is responsible for the review entitlement of commercial and residential developments citywide, leading negotiations with project applicants to address concerns from residents and relevant stakeholders. Prior to that, he was with the City Planning External Affairs Division, where he assigned the primary point of contact for general planning and land use questions. He also worked as Code Studies Division, where he developed land use and landscaping standards. He was also involved in translation with Spanish services for a variety of outreach public meetings. He was also a student worker prior to that, where he worked as a update to the Backyard Beekeeping Ordinance, which was a long ordinance that overturned a 136-year-old ban on urban beekeeping in LA, and he was also part of an award for that recognition and that work. He's a native Angelino and proud child of working-class parents from the Mexican state of Zacatecas. He received his Bachelor of Science in 2015 from Cal Poly Pomona, and this fall he will be pursuing a master's in real estate from Harvard University Graduate School of Design. And we're also joined by Ana Vidal, who was born and raised in Los Angeles, is a proud Latina of Cuban Salvadorian American descent, grew up in the community of Echo Park in North Hollywood, and currently lives in Studio City. Ana has a degree of Bachelor of Arts in Urban Studies from Cal State Northridge, and a Master's in Public Administration, and a Master's in Urban Planning from USC. She has 25 years of experience and 20 years as a Valley Officer Project Planner in every community in the Valley. She worked on policy in Granada Hills. She worked in Valley Development Services Center, promoted to city planner, then moved on to the Metro DSC in 2019, recently promoted to senior planner for the Valley and West LA area. She is a part of the Board of Employee Workforce Action Committee, currently a member of the Racial Justice Subcommittee to encourage diversity and inclusion within the department. Outside of the department, she has volunteered with the APA LA section and California chapter, Latinos in Planning Division, and Southern California Planning Congress by organizing educational events and conferences, a member of the Inclusion Director for Southern California of APA, and organized several diversity summits. In her free time, Ana enjoys traveling, volunteering for her church, cooking, baking, and holiday activities. And we're happy to have both of you join us today. And my co-host and I will be rotating the questions for you. And we're really excited to have you join and learn about your journey and pathways.
So, hey. Yeah, thank you for those introductions, Vidal. I'm really honored, con mucho honor. I'm happy to participate today. And Ana and Jaime, you could just tell us, like, what part of the country are you in right now? And just share a little bit about if you've always lived there and maybe where you grow up.
So I currently live in Los Angeles, California. This is where I was born and raised. I lived in the San Gabriel Valley in Southeast Los Angeles. It's a very working class community out there too. And then as a teenager, my family moved over to Chino Hills, which is in the Inland Empire. I'm not sure how much information what else you would like to know about.
You know, if you're telling us that you grew up in the Inland Empire. Do you have a favorite memory maybe growing up in that area or visiting other places? This is kind of like your moment to share.
So I would say that one of my favorite memories, I would say, is to like the swap meets with my family on Sundays. It's always a cultural, like a mishmash at the swap meets. We would see birds being sold. You would see all types of like music events happening there, like mariachi or banda. Sometimes you would, and I'm not sure if you've been to the Chino swap meet. It's also very agricultural there. Sometimes you would see those like farm animals walking around. So I think I would say that's one of my favorite memories growing up as a kid.
Thank you for sharing that, Jaime. I think a lot of the people that are listening might relate to that, you know, fun experience. And Ana, can you share what part of the world you're in today or what part of the country, and maybe share a little bit about where you grew up?
Yes, I'm in the Van Nuys office currently in the San Fernando Valley, but I have grown up and lived in the LA area all my life. I grew up in the Echo Park area, and then we moved to the Valley when I was after my sister was born, because we didn't have any more room in the apartment we were in. So we moved out to the North Hollywood. My parents bought a house, and we lived there until went to college. And now I currently live in Studio City. It's a nice area that's walkable, and I've always wanted to live in that area because it's close to everything that I love, such as being close to my favorite restaurants, and also my church is walking distance to it. And it's also a cooler part of the valley, so I enjoy that. And growing up, I know in the Echo Park area, we lived in the cul-de-sac, so all of my relatives lived on the same street. In the same building, my aunt lived next door to us and downstairs, and my grandmother and uncle lived down the street at the edge of the cul-de-sac. So that was one of my memories growing up, being together with all my cousins and walking to school and growing up with my cousins as a small child. So those were my favorite memories.
Thank you for sharing those memories. I think you're lighting up like our hearts and our minds, and maybe some of us are going down, you know, memory lane here and playing with our friends and our cousins on the street. You know, I think that's such a beautiful memory. You know, the next question that I have for our participants has to do with maybe how you got involved into planning. You know, if you could maybe share with us how you became involved in the profession. Where did you find your calling for planning? Anything that could, you know, shed light on how you got involved in this, you know, multidisciplinary field, as we all know it. So maybe whether, you know, Jaime or Ana, Jaime, if you want to go first.
Sure. So I would say that my interest in planning is really rooted in my upbringing and the sacrifices that my family has made. So as you might recall, I did live in Southeast Los Angeles, which is a very working class community. It's a very disadvantaged community. At the time, this was back in the 90s, Southeast LA, I guess in certain parts of Southeast LA may still be the case. There's a lot of, there are many lower income families. There are many gaps in education, healthcare, job access. And I would say that it was something that noticeable to me as a kid, especially so when my family moved over to the Inland Empire, where I started seeing, more typical traditional suburban communities where middle-class families might live. I think that just being able to notice, huge difference between different areas of the region really is something that piqued my interest in city planning. It made me wonder, why is it that certain communities are more developed or had more parks, more access to education, good quality education, whereas other neighborhoods weren't, or at least didn't have that privilege. So as a teenager, as I was doing research into just how cities developed or why cities look different, it led me to city planning. And it became a goal to really get involved in city planning, to be able to improve cities through, my profession. So obviously that's what really interested me in pursuing this career.
And for me, I didn't learn about planning until I was in college. And I officially wanted to be an attorney, a lawyer, because that's what I thought I wanted to do. And I took the classes and I wasn't interested, but there was always, there was a flyer my freshman year, Urban Studies, Freshman Welcome. And so I went, and the chair of the department was so welcoming, Dr. Jose Hernandez. And he was very encouraging. And he said, if you want to be a lawyer, you could still have an Urban Studies degree and you could still practice law if you wanted to go that route. And so I took a couple classes and I enjoyed them, and I thought, this is what I want to do. So I transferred from political science into urban studies. At that time, it was just urban studies. And we were encouraged to do internships. And so I did an internship with the City of LA with planning department. And I did it here in the Valley. And I was the intern for one of the city planners in the office, and I did research for them. And I thought, this is what I want to do. This is helping the community, and this is what I want to do. So I kept studying, and it was, I graduated in the early 90s, early to mid 90s. So at that time, the economy was down, and there wasn't opportunities to become an entry-level planner. So I just kept studying. I went into USC and went to graduate school. And that's where I got to work with Metro, the bus and train here in the LA area. It's called the Metropolitan Transportation Authority for Los Angeles one. And I worked at the time right when they merged with the LA Transportation, LACTC, I can't remember what it stands for right now, and RTD, which was the Rapid Transit District. And they had just merged. I was officially an employee of Metro, and I worked in downtown LA 20 hours a week, and I got to work on many projects as an administrative intern. It was my first paid internship. So that helped me understand transportation better. And so that I appreciated that. And I kept studying, and that's what drew me into planning.
And before we move on to the next set of questions, I'm just always curious to find out, how do you explain to your friends and family what you do? How do you explain what an urban planner is? Do they know what your profession entails? I know we've talked about this, in a few other conversations, but I'm just wondering, just knowing from all our backgrounds, how do you translate what you do with your family and friends?
Well, I always tell people, because they don't understand, my family doesn't understand what planning is, but I tell them I'm like the architect for the city, because I remember hearing someone say that, and I was like, that's perfect. So you're the architect for the city. You tell people where to, where should commercial go and where should residential go and all of that. So that's what I tell people that I do. And then once they start asking me questions, they understand what I do. So, and Jaime, if you have a similar experience.
Yeah, I would say my description of profession is fairly similar as well. Usually I get surprised when people just think that cities just appear kind of magically. It seems like it's something that people don't really, I guess the general population doesn't really think about too often. They just don't, I guess, think about how a downtown came to be, for example, or how their neighborhood came to be, or that it can be either an organic or like a very planned process. So it's really interesting just telling people that there's actually government agencies out there that plan like where residential will be located, where commercial will be located, how downtowns will look like. Sometimes I give them an example of one of their favorite neighborhoods in LA or different regions, and I let them know like, oh, the reason why you find this place very, very attractive is because there was a very concentrated effort in making, for example, a community very walkable, encouraging economic development, shops, restaurants in that area. I think that's when people start finally realizing, oh, I guess I can see what the profession really is about.
Yeah, and I know, Anna, you've been involved with, in your line of work and your tenure with the department and a lot of community outreach strategies and also really working with the public. Maybe you could tell us more about how you have thought about this and maybe organizing an event or, you know, any other considerations that you might have in working with, whether it's the public with disabilities or other people or stakeholders that you're wanting to reach to?
Yes, and my work with in policy, when we would have public meetings, we would, you know, notify the people of the community that we were coming out and ask if they had any request that they needed, some mostly like Spanish translation or another language translation, because we did have that in Granada Hills, where it wasn't just Spanish, it was also Chinese. And we do have, luckily at that time, and I think we still do have staff that speak Chinese as well, so that we had those staff available, but also making sure that the location was accessible to people with any other kind of disability. So that was my work in policy. Currently, I work with the public directly at the Development Services Center. So we have also accessibility requests, like people don't have internet, or they don't have a computer, and a lot of our services are available online. But we also are open to making sure that we're accessible to other people that don't have access to the computer. So we assist them in the office, and we assist them with making appointments so that they can come in person. And during COVID, we were still in the office, even though we weren't physically meeting people. And so we would make arrangements with people so that they can drop off whatever items they needed to get reviewed, and then we would assist them to if they weren't able to do it by the computer. We had phones, we can communicate by the telephone, and also the city's disability department would ask us to make sure that we had access not only to our forms available on the internet, but for those who didn't have the internet. So those forms were available, a hard copy if we needed them, so that they had access to all of our services, even if they didn't have access to the internet or the computer.
Yeah, I think, you know, during the pandemic, it became very important, especially as we were going online, to make sure that our PowerPoint presentations were readable, that if we needed to turn on, you know, the captioning wording, that was available. I think just making our information accessible in different places so that if somebody only had a cell phone, right, that they were able to see our websites on the phone. I think obviously we have a long way to go, right? I know that many of us have organized community events to make sure that they're wheelchair accessible, and we've taken other considerations into account, but it almost seems like, yes, we think about these things and sometimes they come to us as an afterthought, but that's just an auto-reflection. I know that we do try to be inclusive, but I think that obviously we have more to go. and making sure that we are being inclusive and considerate and aware of the many needs that our different populations have, right? As we're trying to do our work. We were just discussing this idea or asking the question about, you know, inclusion of populations with disabilities. So I think that, you know, we wanted to move on a little bit to any research projects that you have found potentially, but maybe were exciting to you, or the biggest lesson that you've learned with some of the projects that both you and Anna have worked on. I think it would be great for us to know a little bit about maybe some of those key projects that either taught you a big lesson or you still remember until today, because it was just so inspiring to work on that project. You know, I think that a lot of us have one of those in mind. So we would love to learn more about some of those projects that maybe have really made an impression upon you or left you with just like a big lesson learned that you take with you.
My longest project is my work in policy. I worked almost 10 years on the Granada Hills Community Plan update. We were initially supposed to be only 3 years, but we were never fully funded. And then it happened in 2006, when shortly after the economy went down. And so we had to rethink things, but we didn't want to lose all of our work that we had done. And we didn't want to lose all the good work we had done with communicating with the community and keeping in touch with them, and also keeping all of our plans moving forward. And that was one of the things that I both enjoyed and didn't like doing, because the community could be very stubborn, like, this is what we want. But what they wanted was going to be against the general plan. And so I had to put on my thinking cap with myself and my fellow planners. So what are we going to do to help them to find what they want? And after a lot of back and forth, we came up with a compromise where we would do a combination of general plan amendment changes and also create a new overlay. So they were concerned about their large lots that were developed originally in the 1930s, and those homes would be small on huge lots, or pretty large lots, and they wanted to maintain the original 1930s character. And a lot of the homes in the area that were older and not being maintained were being demolished, and huge homes would be built next to them, so it would dwarf the small little home from the 1930s. And so we came up with a compromise so that people could still, because, you know, in the 1930s, the homes were smaller, the bedrooms were smaller, and we live in different times now where people want a larger home or a larger bedroom, kitchen, and things like that. So we also wanted to make sure we gave them an opportunity to expand, but to keep the character of the house. So I created an overlay that, depending on the size of their house, that's how much they could add on to, and also change the zone so that the larger lots would have a different zone under the same general plan designation, so that those lots couldn't be further subdivided. Or if they were, they would still be large enough to maintain the character of the neighborhood. So that was one that I remember vividly, because I worked very back and forth with the community to make sure that that was done. And then my recent work, going back to the disability also, I had an applicant who didn't have a computer at all. And this was right in the middle of COVID, when public wasn't allowed to come up. So, and she wanted to file her case, and I helped her. Well, I gave her the hard copies. I actually went down and met with her physically, even though, because she wasn't allowed in our offices. I gave her all the paperwork, and then I organized times that we would meet so that she could drop off on her materials and pay. And at the end, she got what she wanted. She got her project approved, and she was very happy, and I was glad that I was able to help someone that I wouldn't have been able to help otherwise if I wouldn't have thought out of the box and said, okay, how can I make this happen?
Can I interject? I just had a follow-up question, Anna. I wanted to ask, since you mentioned about the overlay and the neighborhood context and design, Los Angeles, I imagine, has so many diverse communities and housing types. And I just kind of am curious how, I think you mentioned preservation, right? Some of these old 1930s homes and then obviously new development. Can you talk a little bit just about the challenge of, you know, the general diversity of those neighborhoods and just kind of how it is to kind of, you know, deal with the new and kind of keep that past and that historic look and kind of the challenges your office and you as a planner, you have to make those tough decisions.
Yeah, that was one of the options that the community wanted, was to make it a historic district. But not everyone was in agreement with that, because that would mean a whole different set of regulations on the actual homes. And some of the homes weren't that historic, so that option was gone away pretty early on in the process. But that is one of the options where we do have that option to keep a historic home. And I know that in the Sunland Tahunga area, there are these homes that were built out of river rock. And so we wanted to maintain those homes and their historic nature, and not have people just add another stucco addition to their house when the original house was a stone-looking home, because they use river rocks to build their homes. So that was one option that was considered in Granada Hills, but it didn't have the historic context for these homes. And so that's why we came up with a new overlay, which was the to regulate the residential floor area for each of the homes so that they could still add on to the houses. And also the general plan change was to make it so that it would be more, they could still subdivide, but not make a smaller lot than, like, let's say 10,000 square feet. Because these lots, some of them were 20,000, and they would be broken up into four homes when they previously had just one. And so by dividing, by changing the zone, and they could only divide it in two instead of dividing it into four, so that it could still maintain the character of the neighborhood. Historically speaking, it wasn't officially historic, but I know the city has a variety of overlays, and this was just one of them. So the other ones that the city has are historic or community plan implementations, specific plans, and trying to think of the other ones, pedestrian-oriented districts and transit-oriented districts. So the city has a variety of overlays to address the different needs of the city and each community.
Would you mind repeating the question, Heidi?
Absolutely. I know we went down a path here because, I mean, urban planning is so multidisciplinary, right? I think we could also have an entire podcast on the world of overlays and how our new zoning code system is trying to simplify all that too. So I really appreciate the diversity of projects that we're going to highlight today. So Jaime, if you can please tell us about any projects that have impacted you in a positive way. Maybe it's a big lesson learned on a project or work policy program that you worked on. Maybe it's an experience that you continue to hold on to because it just really motivated you. Any project that you can highlight that you've worked on that has really left a planning print in your heart and soul, it would be nice to hear your experiences on.
Yeah, there's actually two projects I think that really come to mind. I would say one of the projects that had the biggest impact on me was working on the language translation style guide and just the interpretation guide for the city planning department. It really made me realize that there's just so much to be able to reach out to multilingual communities here in Los Angeles that just aren't included as many times in process. So that's something I think all planners should really keep in mind, especially those of us who are working in communities with many disadvantaged, with many people who have who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, I would say, might be speaking other languages.
Yeah, can you tell us more, because I know a lot of people are probably going to be listening to this. How did you work on this? Was it an assignment? Did you just come up with this idea? Were you working in a group on this? Can you tell us a little bit more about how you were assigned to work on this language access guide, and maybe, you know, the experiences that led you to this, right? Like anything that you have been working on before that led you to this work, and how you, you know, worked on the assignment with others and in a department like Los Angeles, right? We're the second largest department. I think there's about 243 languages spoken in the city. So if you could tell us more about those steps that you took in working on this language access guide.
Sure. So I guess the language access guide really is a long time coming. I started with the planning department as an intern back in 2012, so about 10 years ago or so. And I guess through the years as an intern, as a full-time employee as well, I was involved in many different work programs with many different types of community outreach strategies. But one of the things I would notice quite often is that oftentimes at these public meetings where we would solicit input, there was always like very, I guess I would say, like a very specific type of stakeholder that would come in. Usually we didn't have too many, I guess, non-English speaking residents that would be providing public input. So it really made me wonder, like, what is it that the city planning department can do to be able to solicit public input from residents, from stakeholders who only know Spanish, for example, or who might only know Korean, Chinese, Vietnamese, you can go down the line. So as I was thinking about this, I got myself involved with a few other coworkers who were thinking about like similar strategies. So we created this translation committee so that we could start thinking about like what sort of terms could be translated to Spanish, for example, or other languages. And the reason why we started creating this list was so that other translators in our department could have a centralized database to be able to pull these planning terms from. So this database sort of started building and building. And after a while, we started realizing, oh, it's not just a list of planning terms that we need to work. It's a fledged engagement style guide that the planning department really needs so that planners who are working on new community plans, who are working on new ordinances or a different development in the communities, for example, they know like when it is appropriate to be able to translate materials, outreach materials to Spanish, for example, or other languages. So eventually I was assigned as a community liaison. I was assigned to a community liaison role in the external affairs division of city planning. And that's where my responsibility was to develop a Spanish translation style guide, as well as a language access guide for the city planning department. So that's when we really started expanding this database of planning terms, really creating, I would say, a plan for how, I guess, different areas could be translated to Spanish. We also created thresholds for when it would be appropriate to translate to Spanish. And yeah, I guess it's been really helpful for the planning department, because now we have this plan for collecting feedback from community members to identify as limited English proficient Spanish speakers. And it also serves as a template for other communities across the country as well, I would say.
As a follow-up, can you share what kind of feedback you've received from the community or other stakeholders?
Sure. So the first time that we really implemented this style guide was actually around 2020 or 2021, which was a very interesting time because it is also around the start of the COVID pandemic. So as we were trying to solicit input from Spanish-speaking communities, we also had to do it almost entirely through a virtual format, which was, I guess, unexpected a bit for us. But luckily, we actually were able to garner a pretty good audience for some of the virtual workshops that we were hosting for some of the community plans or for some of the other ordinances that were ongoing at the time. And through some of the online strategies in Spanish, we actually were able to increase public participation from Spanish speakers nearly threefold compared to the numbers that we had prior to the COVID pandemic. And so far the input has been really good. I think many people in our community do appreciate that the department started taking a step towards having more materials in Spanish and started really focusing on ensuring that the materials that were being translated were being translated appropriately and professionally. Aside from his feedback from the community, we also received an award from the American Planning Association for the Spanish translation style guide. I believe it was APALA chapter that gave us an award for this.
And I know that you've been such a champion for this effort as well. I know that when you started in the department, right? Like, I know some of us were just asked at the last minute, we need a translator, we need a translator at commission, hurry, or somebody's at the front door and they need help. And I think, a lot of us, and including you, Jaime, have really come to the forefront of leading this effort. So I really want to thank you both, because it's taken a lot of years, right, to get to this point. Anna, can you share any anecdotes or fun memories that you have in translating, whether it's been through your community planning work or the DSC or outside of that? I think that even planning, it's own language, right? So even in talking planning in English and then trying to translate some of these concepts, I think sometimes presents a triple layered challenge to many of us, but nevertheless, rewarding when we can really have these breakthroughs and work with many different communities and understanding what we're trying to do and extending, right, this participatory process that we're trying to foster. Do you have any other anecdotes, Anna, that you could share in, being involved with language access or working with bilingual communities?
When I was working to create one of the overlays, the community design overlay for Pacoima, we were working with the community to have the public hearing, and right before the public hearing, there was a rumor that went around that the city was coming in to take away their properties, and because they knew it was a redevelopment area as well. And so right before the meeting, I had to say, no, that's not what we're doing. We're here to create a guide for any new construction to come in so they can follow these design guidelines. And I explained it, and I had I was the only Spanish translator at the meeting. And so I had to translate what people were saying in English into Spanish, and then the Spanish speakers to translate it to English so that everyone else in the room could also understand. And sometimes there would be times where I was trying to, because you're thinking in English and then you're thinking in Spanish. And sometimes I would, because I was on the microphone, and I would be like, I was literally translating sometimes, and it's like, no, that's not what I meant to say. And then everyone laughed in the room. It was so funny. And so it's just times like that that was one of my memories of translating. It was exhausting by the end of the night, but everyone finally did understand that we weren't going to be taking away their properties, and that we were just providing a guidelines for future development in Pacoima. So, and then my work at the Development Services Center, it's always a relief for the person that's sitting across the counter from me, that, oh, there's someone that can speak Spanish and can explain this. I need help. I just want to add on to my house, and I've been told I need to do this. What do I need to do? So, I can explain what they need to do, and maybe alter it so that they won't have to file an entitlement with us, but then they can, go and do that. So,
yeah, thank you so much. And, I'm sure Vidal, you've had your experiences with that too, right? When somebody comes to us in our line of work, and then you see their nervousness and the stress, and then they kind of smile, and they're like, oh, relieved that somebody can help them, and in such a respectful way, right? In such a courteous manner, but also in a very relatable way, explaining the information and that there's a pathway forward. So thank you for sharing that. Let's see here. I do have another fun question here about, you know, what you envision doing in the next year or two. I think as part of this podcast, we always also like to look forward to a positive outlook here with the future. I'm wondering what your plans are. Maybe it's fun plans for the rest of the summer. Maybe it's what you're doing in the next year or two. We would love to learn more about what some of your plans or goals are for the next couple of months or years, if you already know.
Well, professionally, I'm the newly promoted senior city planner over the Valley and West LA offices, and our West LA office hasn't opened yet. So I'm anticipating that to happen, but it's going to take time because we need to hire staff and train them before we go out and open that office. And I know we have a priority to open the South LA office, which will be a combination of the services that we offer at the Development Services Center, both in Van Nuys and Metro, but also to have the community planners out in the community in South LA. And so that's different than just the Development Services Center, so that the actual community planners, either whether they be project planners or policy planners, going out to the community and being available directly, not instead of having to go into City Hall, they go to their local community center that I think they have a constituent service center that's going into South LA that's already opened, and planning is going to be a part of it. And so that's my plan for professionally. Personally, I'd like to travel more in the country. I've never been to the New England states, so that's my plan. I don't have any exact dates, but I've always wanted to go to Vermont and Rhode Island, and I've never been to those states. The closest I've been is Boston. So I've been there, and so I'd like to go in the fall, because I know we don't have much of a fall here in Southern California, because it always winds up being really, really hot in September, October, right before it gets cold again in late October into November. So we don't have a fall with all the fall colors, you know, the leaves that turn orange and red and yellow and all that. So we have a little bit of it, but I want to experience that in the New England states. So that's what I'd like to do personally, to travel there.
And in my case, I'll actually be going to a graduate school starting fall. I'll be attending, as Vitaly mentioned, Harvard University to obtain a master in realty, which is very different than planning in some ways. But I think it's definitely a field that is very closely related to planning. I think it's important for us in a profession to understand the interplay between planning and development. So that's what I'm mostly interested in, real estate development, and just seeing how we can really encourage the production of new affordable housing. I guess housing that could really be impactful and beneficial for our communities, and I guess development that has socially beneficial outcomes. As well.
Jaime, as a follow-up to that, can you share just about your personal decision in going back to school? You know, you're a working planner, and how you came to that, you know, choice and decision, you know, obviously you want to advance in your career and you have, you know, great vision. Can you share just a little bit about the decision-making thought process?
Right. Yeah, so it was a hard decision. I mean, I've been with the city of LA for more than 10 years now. I really, really enjoy working for the city of LA and being able to work for, I guess, Bello Angelino. Right now I have a job that pays me relatively well. It's good benefits. I have great coworkers. So it was a big change being able to say, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to leave the city to be a graduate student with little to no income. But I would say that going to grad school was always a personal goal of mine. I did my undergrad at Cal Poly Pomona, and almost immediately after graduation, I was hired full time for the city of LA. But in the back of my head, I always wanted to pursue graduate school. We sort of had done kind of on the side over the years. So I was sort of looking into policy, a graduate program in policy, development, perhaps public administration. And it had been a while for me to actually land on something that I thought would be closely aligned to what my passion, I think, really was. And I always kept coming back to the built environment. I'm really passionate about the built environment, urban design. And I started realizing that I think pursuing a further education in something that was related to development would be something that would be a true fit for me. So I had to look into UAB, I had to look into other schools as well. But one other thing I wanted to really focus on was going into a program that was going to place an emphasis on the beneficial outcomes, like socially environmental outcomes of development projects in the communities. That's something that I think many people don't, or at least many people involved in development don't really think about too much. Oftentimes they just think about profit or making a quick project, but I wanted to make sure that I was going to go into a program that was going to place an emphasis on that. So eventually I learned about the new real estate program at Harvard. And thought this was just the right fit. I went to a few of the open houses that the faculty was hosting back in fall of last year, and I thought, wow, this is a really great fit. Many of these professors are working in planning and development roles are very closely aligned to what I was interested in doing. And I guess I applied. It was kind of a shot in the dark because it's Harvard, it's an Ivy League. I didn't think I was actually going to be able to get in, but sure enough, I got an acceptance letter this year. I talked with several of my colleagues, including Heidi, to see what they would recommend, because it is a drastic change from just being fully employed. But eventually I decided that this was really a once in a lifetime opportunity to be able to go to this school. And I'll be attending the Graduate School of Design, which also has a graduate degree in planning, architecture. And it's gonna be really exciting just to be surrounded by all my other fellow peers who are also thinking about I guess innovative ideas within planning, within architecture, landscape architecture, and as well as real estate development. I'm really looking forward to that, just learning about what amazing ideas people are talking about and how we could form relationships so that we can actually improve communities and cities around the world. And what I hope to do after the program concludes is, right now, I'm thinking I will go back to the city of LA. One idea would be to go back to city planning. Another one would be to, for example, join the housing department and really help in the production of affordable housing. There's really many different pathways that I could pursue after this program. But for me, it was really important to be able to understand how the actual development process works outside of City Hall and what we could do, to really increase affordable housing, especially since many of our cities across the country are just facing an extreme housing crisis. And hopefully I'm able to learn what other countries around the world have been doing to increase production of affordable housing, social housing, et cetera. It's gonna be a really interesting, exciting experience and adventure for sure.
And, you know, as part of some of your bios, I know that, Anna, you included a quote that says that you're inspired by this quote, and it says, don't prove yourself, improve yourself. And that's what Anna has as part of her bio. And we're just wondering, Anna, is there like any words of wisdom that maybe in reflecting back in your planning journey that you wish you would have received or that you would want to share with planners that are starting in the profession or maybe starting a new phase, like, you know, Chaim is about to embark on this new graduate school phase and we're all really excited for him. I'm sure you're going to have some tips too, Chaim, if we do another podcast about this topic, we'll catch up with you as well. But Anna, I'm also just wondering, you know, what kind of words of wisdom do you think you would have liked to receive at the beginning of your career? And or do you have any tips for planners, you know, planners that are starting in this wonderful profession?
Yes, I would have, I would say, because I advise my staff to do this, is to take the exams as they come out for the next position that you want to promote into, even if you don't think you're ready for it, because it helps you for when you are ready for it. I know that it's been a long road for me to get promoted, and taking the civil service exam sometimes are not easy at all, especially for the city planner. And you never know what's going to be on the exam. So I always encourage my staff to, you know, to keep studying, to prepare. I have a resources that I give them as well, so that they can be prepared when they're taking the exam. But no amount of studying is going to really prepare you for what's going to be on the exam. And you can just always hope for the best. And sometimes you'll do well, and other times you won't do well. But I would always encourage them, especially because I know that it's how, for me, the way I learn is I have to immerse myself in what I'm doing. And then I can be successful at it. So I know that taking it the first time, I didn't do well. I passed, but not well enough to get promoted. And just keep trying. I know that's always been something I've had my whole life, because always just keep trying. Don't give up. And I think what's important is to be a good writer, so that you can communicate well to both, whether you're writing a report or an email, so that you can communicate well to whoever you're writing. And it helps so that you can articulate yourself both to your staff and to your management as well, so that and as in a concise manner as possible, because everyone is on a time crunch. And I know that when I would I remember one time I was presenting to the city council, and I had my huge presentation ready, and the councilman said, "Get to the point. We have many items on the agenda." And so I was like, "Okay." On the spot, I reviewed the project like in 5 minutes instead of a 20-minute presentation that I had. So that would be my advice, is to, you know, be prepared for anything, and don't give up. That quote, don't prove yourself, improve yourself. I was on a retreat where there was a photographer who had just gotten a job for Life magazine, and he was intimidated because, you know, you've seen Life magazine, all the beautiful pictures that they have. And he was like, how am I going to live up to these pictures? And so the person he was with said, and he came up after all that saying, you know, you don't have to take that picture. That's already been done. You just need to improve on what you've done. So don't compare yourself against another person. Just improve yourself, and that's the way you can move forward. So that's, I've found that an inspiration, because again, it comes back to that, keep trying, don't give up. So.
Yeah, I would tell young planners that are into the profession to really use critical thinking to identify their like true strengths and passions. Like, what is it really that attracts them to city planning? Because as the city planning field is extremely broad, there are so many different career paths that anybody could take. And our education in city planning really gives us, I think, a very wide perspective as to what we could do with our profession. But it really takes our own, I think, effort to navigate or to really push ourselves in the direction that we would like our career to go into. For example, I have some friends who studied city planning in college, but then decided after graduate school they wanted to do landscape architecture. Or some of them perhaps wanted to go into policy so they could be more focused in healthcare planning. In my case, I'm really interested in the built environment, producing more housing, and housing that, and I guess buildings that actually are beautiful and not just run-of-the-mill buildings that are going to be built to, like, too quickly. So in my case, I just went for real estate development. So I would say, that's what I would tell planners, to really think about, young planners, to really think about what their true passion is and what they could do to really pursue that. And I guess that falls also in line with the quote that Ana Vidal mentioned, that it's always important to improve yourself, not improve yourself.
All right. Is there like any other question that maybe we haven't asked that you're just maybe wanting to answer or bring up before we get into the conclusionary piece? Is there anything else that you feel like, wow, I have this plan, Dulce podcast, and I would love to share X, Y, and Z? Anything that comes to mind?
Like, I think it would be incredible to have a podcast that's dedicated on like on what young planners could do to really align their career to what their true passions like really are, perhaps. Perhaps that's something that college students could find very beneficial.
Yeah, thank you for that, Jaime. I think especially now I see it with some of my, in my other hat that I wear as a community college teacher, you know, teaching online is great, but then some of the students are missing this more like, you know, intimate space to really connect with others, right? And we could do this virtually, right? But then also bringing along those topics that really connect, like that human experience with the academic and the personal and the professional. So I think that's an amazing topic that we could continue to pitch here. Yeah.
Well, we like to close our line of questioning with the last question about our topic and our episode, Planning Journeys. But tell us, what is your favorite dessert? Churros? Or do you have a special plan dulce? Pan dulce that you love?
I would say a churro filled with cajeta would be my churro of choice.
Wow. And from where? Where do you get your churros with cajeta?
Usually I go to Olvera Street in downtown. There's a churro place in one of the shops. I guess one of the alleyways, the side that I go to. Churros. Yeah, but nothing really tops Mexico City churros. So those are top.
I like the pan dulce. There's this bakery that's close to my parents' house. I don't know the name of it, but it looks like a little corn. Like a little corn. And yeah. It has a different filling inside, and it's moist. And I love drinking it with or having either coffee or milk with it. And that's my favorite one. And it's just like 5 minutes from where my parents live in Sun Valley. So it's a little bakery that, and they bake them fresh every day. So
thanks. I can relate to that. That's my nephew's favorite. My mom calls it an elotito. It's like, it looks like a little corn, right? Yeah. My favorite are the conchitas, the ones that are on our screen here. That's also was my grandmother's name. And I have such a great connection with my grandmother. She's always present in me. So I love conchitas with a nice cup of coffee. Yeah. How about you, Vidal? What's your favorite?
I like those cuernitos. I like the elote. I like all types of sugary, cinnamony, flavorful fun. And churros, of course, you can't go wrong with churros. I have to add another question because that's our favorite question to ask. But since we're talking about Los Angeles and communities in Los Angeles, do either of you have a special neighborhood that you want to share with our listeners to visit, suggest, you know, visiting and seeing the uniqueness of the many diverse communities and neighborhoods Los Angeles has. Any suggestions for our listeners?
So there's so many great neighborhoods in Los Angeles that it's kind of hard to like really decide which one is it. I'm trying to think of which one would be my top choice. I'm sure Anna already has one in mind.
I have a few, but yeah, there's, and I know that I don't remember the exact name of the restaurant, and maybe Jaime or Heidi, you remember, it was one of the planning days that we had. It's a Oaxacan Mexican restaurant that's in the middle of like Koreatown, and yeah, and they have mole and they hosted us. They were so generous. We had a group of planners come in. And they gave us agua frescas, and they gave us a little taste, like little tacos that they had. And they also had the mole. Yeah, that was it. Thank you, Heidi. And so I would recommend that place. And also, if you're into Thai food, there's in Hollywood, there's a few restaurants that that are great. I can't remember the name of it, but I vividly remember going there. Look, it didn't happen at the time, but it's called the Elvis Thai restaurant. In the evenings, I went for lunch, but in the evenings they have like karaoke with Elvis impersonators singing, and the Thai food was delicious. So those are my recommendations.
I think I have one in mind now. I would say my top recommendation would be to visit Santee Alley. I think I love Santee Alley because there's just such a mishmash of like different vendors and people. You have really anything you can think of in that area of the city, and it's just so organic. It's almost the opposite of a planned community. It almost seems like organized chaos. Just seeing the amount of different kinds of vendors, you found different companies. The amount of different shops, restaurants that you can see. It makes for an exciting, I think, Sunday morning or Saturday morning when you go there, and just make it like as if it were like a little local fair. That way.
Excellent. How about you, Heidi? Do you have any favorite places?
Well, I mean, I have a lot of favorites, but I think if you're coming to Los Angeles, you have to have a taco. Like any taquero, any street taco, right? We're not going to get all territorial about who has the best tacos across the country. But I think, you know, having a taco from whether it's Avenue 42 Tacos, if you Google tacos in Los Angeles, you'll find a taquero. There's so many. There's Carnitas El Momo. I mean, there's just so many taco places. But I would recommend that you visit one. And sometimes they do have veggie options in case you're vegetarian. But having a taco in Los Angeles, I think, is a must, at least once if you visit us.
I grew up in Northeast LA, so I'm going to suggest our listeners come visit my neighborhood town of Highland Park and check out the cool, you know, there's all of these trendy places popping up left and right down there. So that'll be my recommendation for our listeners.
I like that. You visit the trendy and then you also have a taco, right? You support both. All right.
Well, I want to thank our guest today, Anna, Jaime. Thank you for joining us and sharing your planning journeys, wonderful stories and experiences with our listeners. And I want to thank my co-host, Heidi. Thank you so much for joining us on this conversation. We want to remind our listeners that our podcast is available on all the platforms, and you can listen to all our other great episodes from our other co-hosts and members. And we want to also promote the upcoming Lugares Conference. It's a virtual conference presented by us, the Latinos in Planning Division. It's going to be in November, and it'll be virtual, and we'll have all of the news coming out on that pretty soon, and registration will be opening up very soon as well. And you can also join the division membership as a student for free. We know Jaime is going to take advantage of that opportunity. And all the other membership rates are all listed on the APA website for that. If you're not a planner, and we love non-planners, there's also a special non-planner member rate, $40. So thank you all for joining us today. We hope to hear from you again.